No one knew it at the time, but the June 4 to 7, 1942 battle in the skies over and around a tiny atoll in the Pacific was the turning point in the war against the Empire of Japan. I'm Oliver North, and this War Stories podcast is the eyewitness account of the Battle of Midway. As you'll hear, for the sailors, airmen, and Marines who survived it, the epic Battle of Midway, 6 months after the surprise attack on Pearl Harbor, was seared into their memories. The fight required brilliant intelligence work by codebreakers, expert battle planning, and the leadership of a determined admiral named Chester Nimitz to halt the Imperial Japanese Navy's seemingly unstoppable sweep across the Pacific. In this exciting War Stories podcast, you'll hear about how the intelligence unit at Station Hypo ingeniously broke the unbreakable Japanese code to deliver victory in this epic battle. Listen carefully to two pilots, one Japanese and the other American, as they describe how they bombed each other's aircraft carriers. This was a war of nerves between two legendary admirals, Chester W. Nimitz and Isoroku Yamamoto. Together, they squared off in the Pacific to fight what historians call the Battle of the Century.
Are you hiring? Do you know where to post your job to find the best candidates? With ZipRecruiter, you can post your job to 100-plus job sites with just one click. Then their powerful technology efficiently matches the right people to your job better than anyone else. That's why ZipRecruiter is different. Unlike other job sites, ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them. In fact, over 80% of jobs posted on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate in just 24 hours. No juggling emails or calls to your office. Simply screen, rate, and manage candidates all in one place with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard. Find out today why ZipRecruiter's been used by businesses of all sizes to find the most qualified job candidates with immediate results. And right now, listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/war. That's ZipRecruiter.com/war. One more time. Try it for free. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/war.
Good evening. I'm Oliver North, and this is War Stories. I'm standing on the flight deck of the Fighting Lady, the aircraft carrier USS Yorktown, here at Patriots Point Naval and Maritime Museum in Charleston, South Carolina. This carrier was commissioned barely 10 months after her namesake was sunk by the Japanese during the epic Battle of Midway in June of 42. For the sailors, airmen, and Marines who survived it, Midway was seared in their memories. Though they didn't know it at the time, it was the turning point in our fight against the Japanese during World War II. As you will see, it took brilliant intelligence work, expert battle planning, and the leadership of a determined admiral named Chester Nimitz to carry the day. It sure as hell wasn't easy. At the time, the Japanese were at their strongest militarily, having won every battle in the South Pacific, while a substantial portion of our Navy lay at the bottom of Pearl Harbor.
We were getting ready to go on a picnic, and my father got a phone call, said something to my mother, and left. And that was very early in the morning, 7:15.
She was only 10 years old on that terrible day, but Janet Ellerding remembered the reaction of her father, Lieutenant Commander Joseph Rochefort.
It was terrible, awful. They were afraid that the Japanese were going to land and do more damage. And he sent a friend over with a gun for my mother.
Pearl Harbor was choked with the grim reminders of Admiral Yamamoto's surprise attack. It was particularly painful for 43-year-old Joseph Rochefort. As a Navy intelligence officer and linguist, he had spent happy years living in Japan with his wife and family. Rochefort even got to know a young Emperor Hirohito.
That were given to me by the Emperor when I was born. This is the dad, the mama, and the baby.
Rochefort had a very strong feeling that at the beginning of the war, he had failed his commander-in-chief by not giving him warning of the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor.
Then, a 22-year-old ensign out of Iowa, Max Showers, worked as a codebreaker at the base with Rochefort.
We now know that there's no way he could have known about it because it was executed in total radio silence. but Rochefort took it personally. This gave Rochefort a dedication to his task, which he passed on to his people.
The reaction of the American people was, of course, anger and frustration at how this had occurred.
In Japan, Admiral Yamamoto, who led the attack, was hailed as a conquering hero. Hitler sent his congratulations and promptly declared war on the United States. And Washington demanded the head of Admiral Husband Kimmel, then in charge of the Pacific Fleet.
I am one of the school who thinks that Admiral Kimmel has been made a scapegoat.
In congressional hearings, Admiral Kimmel hinted at political games being played in Washington. He said the Navy Department had been less than forthcoming about the deterioration in relations with Japan just days before the surprise attack.
I cannot understand now. I have never understood. I may never understand why I was deprived of the information available in the Navy Department in Washington on Saturday night and Sunday morning.
But Kimmel was out, and President Franklin Roosevelt called upon a tall, cool Texan, Chester W. Nimitz. It was a job Nimitz had turned down before.
He actually had been asked to take command of the Pacific Fleet somewhat earlier, maybe a year or two earlier. And he was so much junior to so many of the admirals. And he said, you know, if I do that, it will make me so many enemies that he really preferred not to.
Sister Mary Aquinas is the youngest of Nimitz's four children.
Maybe my mother knew already, but I think it was at the dinner table he told the rest of us. Franklin Roosevelt sent my father word that he had to get out to the Pacific and to stay there till the war was won.
He had no choice.
My mother had very much the philosophy she worried about him when he was home, and she let God worry about him when he was away.
Catherine Nimitz and her husband were close. They exchanged hundreds of letters during the war. On the morning of December 31st, 1941, aboard the submarine USS Grayling, 56-year-old Chester Nimitz added his fourth star and took command of a disheartened Pacific Fleet.
I am about to assume a great responsibility, and I assure you that I shall do my utmost to meet it.
Nimitz, not without a wry sense of humor, was heard to say that the Grayling had the only deck available to use for his ceremony, courtesy of the Japanese.
He's a very serene man. He's very quiet and easygoing. It's a remarkable personality in terms of his ability to deal with people.
My father was successful in bringing together a fighting force that included such men as Bull, Halsey, people whose nicknames betrayed their energy of spirit. My father, I think, found MacArthur somewhat difficult to work with, but made it work.
Chester Nimitz was a long way from the hill country of Fredericksburg, Texas. He grew up in this hotel in a tightly knit German-American community. He was raised by his mother, Anna, and beloved grandfather, Charles, after his father and namesake died before he was born. In 1905, as a young midshipman at the Naval Academy in Annapolis, Nimitz had learned an important lesson.
These midshipmen had discovered that there were places in Bancroft Hall on the roof, and it was not visible from other parts of the academy. So that had become a place for beer parties and other such entertainments. They drew lots to see who would get to go get the beverage, and the lot fell to my father.
What the young Nimitz didn't know was that while he was scoring the illegal beer at a local tailor shop, it had been witnessed by one of his instructors.
And he thoroughly expected to be told, after you march your platoon out, come back for a little conference. And that did not happen. And he was not sent for by the superintendent of the Naval Academy. And what he learned from this was two things: not to play fast and loose with the regulations, and also to be lenient with first offenders.
Nimitz also learned tolerance and forgiveness of mistakes. In July 1908, he ran his first command, the destroyer Decatur, aground. He was court-martialed and survived with a public reprimand for neglect of duty. He'd later say every dog deserves two bites. This philosophy served him well as he rebuilt the shattered morale at Pearl Harbor.
Yamamoto apparently was quite a cut-up when he was here in Washington. He had a reputation as quite a party animal.
There were stories about him standing on his head at parties. A very, very animated fellow. Yamamoto had been naval attaché in Washington. He'd studied at Harvard. He had been to America. He knew basically the American culture, the American people. He knew that when aroused, they could be, very formidable enemies.
I look forward to dictating the peace to the United States in the White House at Washington.
The two admirals were only a year apart in age, and they shared admiration for the legendary Admiral Togo, the victor over the Russians at the Battle of Tsushima Straits.
It's like both sides, really knew the other. I mean, we had dossiers on the various Japanese flag officers.
I mean, this is a remarkable counterintelligence and intelligence operation at the same time.
Very interesting sort of game of cat and mouse that's going on. A lot of battle of wills, battle matching wits with your enemy.
The stage was set for a showdown between Nimitz and Yamamoto, but where would it take place? Meet the man who Nimitz was told to fire, but thank God he didn't. See how Joseph Rochefort broke the Japanese code and laid their battle plans bare. That's next on War Stories. Spring 1942, the Japanese war machine was bulldozing its way through the South Pacific at breakneck speed. Jack Green is a curator at the Naval Historical Center.
The United States has been losing the Second World War. We've had a disastrous defeat at Pearl Harbor. Our possessions of the Guam and the Philippines have fallen, and they had the momentum of victory behind them. We had had primarily defeat.
Did the Japanese suffer from an excess of self-confidence, a victory disease, as it were?
Victory disease figured very prominently in how the Japanese were operating in April, May, June 1942. The Japanese Navy didn't think very highly of our naval aviation capability.
We had kept winning, especially since Pearl Harbor. So I think it's natural that any military force like that would become more confident and start feeling invincible.
Outmanned and outgunned, Admiral Nimitz knew that victory in the Pacific would require all of his skills. His most valuable weapon was hidden inside a small windowless basement at Pearl Harbor, Station Hypo.
I arrived at Hypo in February 1942. I was an ensign. I knew that I was sent to an intelligence unit that was working for the Pacific Fleet. I went to the Navy Yard and reported to Commander J.J. Rochefort.
Max Showers was an Iowa farm boy who discovered his new assignment involved cryptology, the breaking of enemy codes. It was a top-secret operation with long hours in less than glamorous surroundings.
The basement was relatively cold and damp, and people had to have extra clothing in order to work comfortably down there.
Lieutenant Commander Joseph Rochefort was brilliant, renowned for his mathematic ability and command of the Japanese language, but his working attire was unusual, to say the least.
Well, he used to wear slippers and his red velvet smoking jacket when he was working.
When I first saw Commander Rochefort in his maroon smoking jacket and bedroom slippers, I was not particularly surprised for two reasons. First of all, I figured a commander could do anything he wanted to. And it was cold. It was uncomfortable. But when he left the basement, he was in his proper uniform.
Working with Rochefort was Commander Edwin Layton, another crack intelligence officer that Nimitz kept on despite the Pearl Harbor disaster.
Commander Layton was a good friend of Rochefort's, and they had known each other a long time. They'd studied Japanese language together in Japan for 3 years. Layton was somewhat more flamboyant and forceful. The two worked very closely together. They trusted each other. Layton was a very persuasive individual. He was the perfect man to be Admiral Nimitz's intelligence officer.
Station Hypo set out to break JN-25, the Japanese code. Thousands of messages were being sent daily, transmitted by the enemy in Morse code.
It could be copied by intercept operators who had headphones, and they would tune in on the frequencies that the Japanese were using. They had typewriters with Japanese characters. After those messages were copied, they would be sent down to our processing unit.
Station Hypo was working with some 45,000 five-digit code groups and deciphering them into English. The code breakers were lucky to recover 15% of any message, but that was enough.
That was the name of the game, recover enough code groups so that as we could read a message and know the meaning of a code group, we could put together the sense of the message. Little by little, we were able to fill in the blanks, recover more words. This all came from a code book the Japanese had that was as big as a dictionary. They had thousands and thousands of code groups in there, each one meaning something, the name of a ship, the name of a person, a number, a position, a place.
This intelligence was crucial, but Nimitz was wary of Washington's meddling, the kind that had ruined his predecessor, Admiral Kimmel.
And when he first got to Pearl Harbor, he discovered that the materials or the intelligence that was coming into Station Hypo was being sent on to Washington, D.C., and he said, that's got to stop. I want everything that comes through here.
Rochefort was sitting in the basement producing this information and giving it to Layton, who would look it over, digest it, understand it, perhaps ask questions on it himself, and then he would pass it to Admiral Nimitz. Nimitz could have relieved Commander Rochefort along with a lot of other people. But he knew that they were qualified, hard-working people.
One lieutenant colonel said it appeared the Japanese Navy was prepared to use everything but Emperor Hirohito and a bathtub with an outboard motor to attack us. And how could Admiral Nimitz get his battered fleet back in fighting shape? That's next on War Stories. Station Hypo's initial success led to the enemy's first major setback.
By April of 1942, we were now able to read enough of Japanese messages to realize that they were mounting a major operation in the South Pacific. It put them within flying distance of Australia. But we had enough idea of this operation to tell Admiral Nimitz that it was occurring.
But first, there was a score to settle, payback for Pearl Harbor. On April 18th, Nimitz approved a bold plan. From the pitching deck of the USS Hornet, Admiral Bull Halsey sent Jimmy Doolittle and his team of 16 B-25s to bomb downtown Tokyo.
There are some who say that that Yamamoto's decision to attack at Midway was forced upon him by the Doolittle raid.
I think that would be accurate.
Yamamoto was under intense pressure to finish what he'd started at Pearl Harbor, the destruction of the U.S. fleet. 2.5 weeks after bombs dropped on Tokyo, the fleets faced off in the Battle of the Coral Sea.
Isn't Coral Sea the very first time that two fleets engage each other without ever seeing each other?
The Japanese spend a lot of time looking for our carriers and are unable to find them. They're beyond gun and torpedo range.
On board the Yorktown was aviation mechanic Bill Sergi from Louisiana. Barely 18 years old, he experienced his first taste of war.
I was forward of the island in a catwalk, and a near miss kills my buddy, P.C. Myers, first person I've ever seen killed. The bomb went through the flight deck, the gallery deck, the hangar deck, mess deck, living spaces deck, and the supply deck. We have compartments in here that we lived in, and when that bomb went off, we now have a space of a theater that big. And there were 54 people there, 4 people, so they got out alive.
The battle cost both sides plenty. Over a 36-hour period, 2 Japanese carriers were left burning but managed not to sink. Besides the Yorktown, the Lexington was hit hard by Japanese torpedo bombers. Both carriers began limping back to Pearl Harbor, but then the Lexington's ruptured fuel lines exploded into an inferno. Captain Frederick Sherman called for his crew to abandon ship, and Admiral Aubrey Fitch ordered the Lexington torpedoed to keep her out of Japanese hands. Meanwhile, the Yorktown struggled on.
How long does it take you to get back to Pearl Harbor?
Over a week it took us to get back.
And the estimate is it's going to take 90 days to fix it.
Right.
But 3 months was time Admiral Nimitz didn't have.
He said, we must have the ship back in 3 days.
And he needed it back in 3 days because he knew what?
He knew when the Japanese were going to launch their offensive.
They never repaired it. They drilled wooden pegs in the holes. We had other near misses on the port side, which gave us an oil leak.
Meanwhile, Station Hypo was in high gear. Typically, Rochefort's team went 20 hours straight, with only an occasional nap.
We were already seeing indications of a much bigger operation that was going to take place in the Central Pacific. And we discovered that the target for this operation was a place described by the Japanese in their internal code system as AF. We knew that A stood for an American territory. We didn't know what F was, but our guess was that it was Midway Island.
Washington was doing its best to discredit Station Hypo, insisting Japan would attack Alaska, Hawaii, or even the coast of California. But Rochefort was convinced the target was Midway, a tiny, sweltering atoll known for goonie birds and an airstrip. And he knew they'd attack in 3 weeks.
He was stubborn as a mule, and if he made his mind up and was convinced he was right, he'd fight forever for what he thought was right, regardless of what happened to him.
Midway is strategically significant because of its proximity to Hawaii. Whoever controlled Hawaii can basically attack the west coast of the United States.
His career was really on the line, because had he been wrong, it would have been not well accepted in Washington, D.C.
For further proof, Rochefort's team came up with an ingenious plan. Believing the Japanese had coded Midway as AF, they had the little island send out this bogus radio message, which was easily intercepted by the Japanese.
The AF air unit sent the following message to Hawaii, saying that on the 20th of May, that they had suffered a casualty of their freshwater supply and that they only had enough freshwater for 2 weeks.
And the Japanese took the bait.
24 hours later, they intercepted a message which the air unit at AF reported to Hawaii. They only had a 10-day water supply. Oh, that cinched it. We knew right then that AF was Midway.
Coming up, the Battle of Midway begins in fury, and Torpedo Squadron 8 pays the ultimate price. This was before satellites could pinpoint an enemy's location. Over 64 million square miles of blue water. It was a high-stakes game of cat and mouse. Mark Horan worked with historian Robert Cressman on a glorious page in our history.
Yamamoto was convinced that the United States Pacific Fleet would have to come out and react to any invasion of Midway, and he wanted a battle to get after our carriers that he had missed at Pearl Harbor.
The Enterprise and the Hornet go out on the 28th of May, which is ironically the same day Yorktown goes into dry dock to begin her magnificent repair job.
The ship was not what we call seaworthy, but the flight deck was operational. It was just a hole in the flight deck. There was no problem.
They patch it?
Yeah. Well, I just put a piece of metal over it. Four nails, a nail in each corner.
They had achieved the impossible for Admiral Nimitz, repairing the Yorktown in 3 days instead of 3 months. After a personal tour by Nimitz, she set off in the morning of May 30th to join the Hornet and the Enterprise. Meanwhile, Nimitz gave the tiny island all the fortification it could take. Nearly 3,400 Marine and Navy defenders were crammed into its 2.4 square miles.
There's very limited space on this island in which you could put anything else.
Basically, Midway is packed with airplanes. The Army Air Force weighs in with B-17 Flying Fortress bombers. The Navy is operating Catalina flying boats. And the last of the Navy reinforcements are a small detachment, a half dozen aircraft of Grumman TBF-1 Avengers, which are from Torpedo Squadron 8.
You've got a handful of aircraft that really aren't up to the same standard as a Japanese aircraft.
Yeah, there was the perception at the time that the Marines were definitely given substandard equipment.
While the Navy had the new PBY Catalina flying boats, the Marines of Air Group 22 were handed down the older Vindicators, nicknamed Vibrators. As you can see from this cartoon, the Marines at least had a sense of humor about it.
The Marine pilots who flew them had an incredible amount of courage and bravery. They did a wonderful job with what they had.
Also on Midway was famed Hollywood director John Ford. He was working for the Navy and taking these pictures when a costly mistake nearly jeopardized the operation on May 22nd.
We had stockpiled a tremendous amount of fuel for our seaplane base there. Prior to the battle, a electrical switch that was being wired into the island's defenses was accidentally triggered and set off a huge underground fuel tank.
350,000 gallons of precious aviation fuel went up in smoke.
The loss of all that aviation fuel greatly restricted the amount of training time the Marine pilots were going to be able to use.
We know where the Japanese fleet is. We know when it's coming. We know what it's got. The preparations are all in place for a very dramatic showdown. Who makes the decision in terms of who's going to attack first? I mean, it's like chess.
Well, basically what the Japanese want to do is send in an airstrike to pound the air facilities and the hangars and the seaplane base and just launch this massive airstrike from their carrier.
Yamamoto's convinced that he'd be able to seize the atoll, base his own planes there, and then the Americans would come to him.
But on June 3rd, the day before his attack on Midway, Yamamoto made a strategic mistake. Nearly 1,800 miles away, he ordered his forces to bomb Alaska's Dutch Harbor.
Because of the victory disease and the overconfidence of the Japanese at this time, Yamamoto feels he can take on both operations at the same time.
There is a Japanese proverb, if you chase two rabbits, you won't get even one of those. Japan was actually chasing two rabbits then. Our aim for the Midway attack was not perfectly clear.
Although 25 Americans were killed, we captured our first Japanese Zero when its pilot crashed into a bog.
The airplane was so intact that they were able to repair it and then test it here in Washington, D.C.
You're looking at that Zero flying new colors. It would prove to be crucial to building a better airplane to take on our enemy. Aboard the carrier Hiryu, Taisuke Murayama hoped he and his BN-25 Kate would have the same luck he'd had at Pearl Harbor when he sank the Oklahoma.
I had a Japanese sword as my lucky charm. Every time I flew, I took the sword with me. We said, Toshore, Toshore. It means get ready for the fight.
In the early morning hours of June 4th, the four Japanese carriers launched their strike. What they didn't know was that Nimitz had three carriers lurking off the atoll, waiting for the right moment to pounce. On Midway, the Marines and Navy defenders took a heavy pounding.
Let's talk about the day of the battle.
I got up at 3 o'clock in the morning, had breakfast, pushed eggs around the plate.
Aboard the Enterprise, 23-year-old Ensign Lewis Hopkins from Georgia readied his SBD Dauntless Dive Bomber, nicknamed Slow but Deadly. He was part of Bombing Squadron 6, and each plane carried a single 1,000-pound bomb.
First time I'd ever carried a live bomb. And this was about 7:20 in the morning when I took off. And got there at about 9:20 or thereabouts. They weren't there. And so our flight leader thought he'd go ahead another 15 minutes or so. And all the ensigns and I guess the other people were looking at the navigation plotting board and saying, hey, I'm going to be short of fuel. How am I going to get back?
As the day went on, as airstrike after airstrike did not achieve any damage on the Japanese ships, things were beginning to look pretty grim. It was actually pretty questionable about 9:30 in the morning on June 4th if we were going to manage to win the battle at all.
While Hopkins was running out of fuel, Torpedo Squadron 8 was running out of luck. 16 TBD bombers from the Hornet ran into a swarm of Zeros.
At that time, the Japanese had 28 Zeros in the air. There were no fighters with Torpedo Squadron 8. The 15 airplanes had all been shot down and 29 of the 30 aircrew had been killed.
There's only one survivor of the Torpedo Squadron 8 attack, and it's Ensign George Gay.
The wounded ensign floated under a raft and was rescued. He recovered and was hailed as a hero. His fallen comrades were immortalized in this film shot by John Ford and sent to the families of the lost squadron. Meanwhile, just before he ran out of fuel, Hopkins spied his target, the carrier Akagi.
We arrived over the Japanese fleet at 10:20. And so we dive-bombed the Akagi. As I dropped my bomb, I'm attacked by a Japanese fighter plane. And so I take all the evasive maneuvers that I can, and I look back and I see three carriers with explosions and burning taking place.
You're obviously very and justifiably proud of the fact that all the damage was done by airplanes like the one you were flying.
You bet. But I couldn't just continue to look, I had to think about getting back to the Enterprise.
Coming up, he does it first at Pearl Harbor, then again at Midway. A Japanese pilot scores a direct hit. This time it's the Yorktown that sinks to a watery grave. That's just ahead on War Stories.
Outcome had been decided in that five-minute span on June 4th, between 10:25 and 10:30.
Lewis Hopkins was low on fuel when he took his shot at the Akagi in his SBD Dauntless. The Japanese called them hell divers.
Quite an airplane. It's for its mission capability and the ability to do the job for which it was designed, there was nothing better.
His Dauntless dove at a 60-degree angle with airspeeds approaching 300 miles per hour.
From 22,000 feet to 2,500 feet where you release the bomb, there's 42 seconds.
The lower you go, the more accurate delivery, but the more scary the pullout is. The dive is near vertical. All the time, the enemy anti-aircraft guns are shooting up at them, and sometimes there's fighter planes coming in after them.
By 11 a.m., three of the four Japanese carriers were engulfed in flames. The Akagi, Kaga, and Soryu were out of commission. Yamamoto was stunned. By 12:30, he ordered his remaining carriers and the Aleutians to head for Midway.
Here is this ship, dead in the water, people abandoning ship, and water all around, and we're dropping bombs on it.
Akagi couldn't let the planes take off. It was attacked by America with torpedoes fully loaded on it and a lot of fuel in its hangar. It exploded. The Akagi was covered by big fire and sunk.
At around 1:30 p.m., 19-year-old pilot Taisuke Murayama, vowing to avenge the devastation, launched from the last remaining Japanese carrier, the Hiryu.
I was determined, and I went for fighting with deep sorrow inside my heart. 18 planes of ours flew to Yorktown to attack it.
On board the Yorktown, 18-year-old Bill Sergi was about to be bombed for the second time in a month.
Where's it hit?
On the flight deck, the bomb went down and started a small fire forward. Third bomb went down the stack and to the same vicinity where we had all this damage before. And when it went off, it now opened all this space to be the size of a stadium. And one airplane kept coming toward the ship.
Your friend Mariano.
Right.
I was flying across the bridge. Bill Sergi told me he saw my plane then.
I thought this guy was saluting us when I went by. His arm was waving. And everybody says, well, he couldn't be doing that. He's probably shaking his fist at us. Now, these torpedoes are coming in, and they go off right under me. So that throws me into the overhead, which hits my skull here. If I didn't have this on, I'd have been splattered all over the overhead. I wake up from that dripping water and oil and everything else. My God, there's the ocean.
You wearing this?
Yep. And I go down the side, and I'm in the water. And I'm in the water wearing this hat, and some officer says, son, you better take that hat off. It'll cause you to sink.
While he drifted away, Sergi watched the fire's rage as the fighting lady began to list badly. Close to 3 p.m., Captain Elliot Buckmaster feared that the Yorktown would explode and kill more than 2,000 of her remaining crew. He ordered the ship to be abandoned. Survivors, including Sergi, were picked up by destroyers like the Benham.
So I grabbed that net, and there was no way I was going to let go of that.
Nimitz refused to let go of the Yorktown and sent tugs from Task Force 17 to try and salvage his precious carrier. Meanwhile, the Hiryu had only hours to live. Dive bombers from the Enterprise and the crippled Yorktown found her and hit her hard at 5:30 p.m.
It was like a sea of fire. Hiryu was totally covered with fire.
And like his enemy Bill Sergi, Murayama found himself afloat on the sea.
Why did the Japanese hide their survivors from the Battle of Midway, including their ace pilot Murayama? And what did Admiral Nimitz do to stop the vendetta against Joseph Rochefort? That's next on War Stories.
The Japanese fleet was in shambles, and at 2:55 a.m. on June 5th, Admiral Yamamoto ordered the Midway operation canceled.
A devastating
loss for the Japanese.
The casualties suffered by the Japanese were 2,500, 307 on the American side. The Japanese lose four carriers, we lose one.
I often can't sleep at all when I think of my colleagues who died in the war. 86% of my fellow pilots died.
The devastation to their training system from Midway was far greater than the Americans because they did not rotate their air crew to bring back the important combat experiences they had. The Japanese would keep their old air crew out until they died or were captured.
A sickened and disheartened Yamamoto took full responsibility for the disaster and insisted that he give the bad news to the emperor. Some of his senior officers, including Vice Admiral Nagumo, had to be talked out of committing suicide.
Nagumo was sent off to defend, you know, another Japanese island and commit suicide at the back end of the war. But Yamamoto isn't subjected to that same revulsion. Why?
Yamamoto is a revered figure. Of course, he feels this loss deeply because it was, of course, his idea.
While Yamamoto licked his wounds, Admiral Nimitz was intent on saving the badly damaged Yorktown, which was hobbling back toward Pearl Harbor.
I think from my father's letters home, there was a certain anxiety expressed because he knew he could not get much in the way of new ships.
But even in defeat, Yamamoto proved dangerous. He sent Submarine Squadron 3 to stalk the Yorktown. And at 7 p.m. on June 6th, I-168 fired off four torpedoes. Two were direct hits. At 5 a.m. the following morning, the Yorktown and her escort, the Hammond, sank to a watery grave.
Japanese planes fought off by American guns.
But nothing could diminish the victory at Midway. It was the first good news of the war. At SINCPAC headquarters on Oahu, Nimitz was congratulated, and the champagne flowed freely. He gave special credit to Station Hypo and recommended Commander Joseph Rochefort for a Distinguished Service Medal.
Washington told Admiral Nimitz that they would like to have certain people recognized with awards.
My father many times, or three times, I think, recommend Rochefort for a medal.
And this, of course, drives other people a little nutty because they get jealous. They get upset that they weren't there first. And this was particularly true even within the Navy in the communications intelligence business between the field units such as HIPO in Hawaii and the headquarters in Washington.
Rochefort was denied the medal. His daughter Janet remembers her mother's reaction.
Well, you know, your father really got a bum deal.
I think that was one of the first instances in which I learned that men could be so petty. And to think of doing it in the middle of a war just was kind of appalling to me when I learned that.
Back in Tokyo, the Japanese survivors of Midway, including Moriyama, were kept hidden on a military base.
The Japanese wounded who come back from the Battle of Midway are treated almost as though they were prisoners of war.
Treated almost like they had the plague. The true story of Midway was withheld from the Japanese people because of the tremendous effect that it would have on morale.
We went back to Japan. We were like under house arrest there. House arrest. We were not allowed to communicate with anyone outside. No letters either. Not allowed to go out.
There's more ahead on War Stories. Don't go away. Back in the cold basement of Station Hypo, Joseph Rochefort lived by the motto, "We can accomplish anything, provided no one cares who gets the credit." But that's not how they felt in Washington.
The intelligence community has much the same kind of competition that a newspaper or radio and television today have. People want to get scoops.
Rochefort had made some very big enemies. Two of them were brothers, Navy intelligence officers John and Joseph Redmond. Edwin Layton would later state that they had pursued a vendetta against Rochefort and got him booted from HIPO.
I have received this afternoon a message from the Japanese government which specifies the unconditional surrender of Japan.
Nimitz lived to see total victory over the Japanese, and his place in history is secure. But up until his death in 1966, Nimitz tried to right the wrong done to Rochefort.
Admiral Nimitz sat down and wrote a handwritten 2-page letter to the Secretary of the Navy asking that the case be reexamined and that Commander Rochford again be given the Distinguished Service Medal for his outstanding work at the Battle of Midway. The answer that went back to Admiral Nimitz was that World War II awards had been closed by that time and that they could not reopen the files.
Joseph Rochford died in 1976 without recognition for his achievements. It took Max Showers to finish the job that Nimitz had started.
It took a lot of effort, it took a lot of persuasion, but in 1985, we finally got the Secretary of the Navy to approve the posthumous award of a Distinguished Service Medal to Commander Rochford, and that was presented by President Reagan in the White House.
He did this, I think, practically single-handedly. He was just quite pleased. He said, a great wrong has been righted.
She now lies more than 3 miles beneath the sea. With her guns still pointing skyward, the Yorktown is a ghostly shadow of her former self. Nearly 60 years after she sank, she brought old enemies together once again.
This is Mariama, the same guy that
Mariama, right.
I surely feel the bond. Once the war ended, we were not enemies anymore. I could even feel more familiar with him than anyone who didn't know the battle.
I've met him. We've been to his home in Japan. Anyway, we're drinking buddies now, and we'll raise a toast of peace, right?
America's victory at Midway came at a point in time when we desperately needed good news from the Pacific. Admiral Nimitz said of the victory that it was a glorious page in our history. And he still faced 3 more years of brutal carnage in the Pacific. His youngest daughter, Sister Mary Aquinas, was kind enough to share with us his handwritten copy of his Principles of War, 3 of which mean a lot to me: offensive, surprise, and economy of force. And beneath it, he wrote in his own hand on this piece of notebook paper, "While all the observance of these principles of war won't guarantee victory, violation of most will almost certainly ensure defeat." For those who fought at Midway with Admiral Chester Nimitz, those words were certainly true. Theirs was a war story that deserved to be told. I'm Oliver North. Good night.